Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Tuesday, the 25th of June. Coming up on the program, GNU jitters continue. How will a new government tackle the widening economic gap in the country? Spending priorities for the Defence Force already on its knees? And why healthcare workers are protesting in KwaZulu-Natal? Now, reports today suggesting that the Democratic Alliance and the ANC are nearing some form of agreement on the number of ministers that each party is going to have in their efforts to form a broad coalition government with other smaller parties. Let's start the program with specialist political writer Natasha Marion from News 24. Natasha, a very warm welcome to you. And I get the sense that this is like watching the Comrades Marathon being run backwards in the dark. How close are we to any agreement?
Thanks, Jeremy. That's exactly what it's like. It's been such a roller coaster, up and down. One day it's, one day they're agreeing, the next day they're not agreeing. But what we've seen in the last 24 hours, that especially after the meeting between President Cyril Ramaphosa and John Steenhuisen, the DA leader yesterday, that, you know, the meeting was very constructive and they have moved forward. So we're likely to see an announcement on that deal in the next 24 hours, potentially.
Natasha, is it getting more and more difficult, do you think, to accommodate this ever-expanding ship?
I think that's been among the sticking points, because as more parties have been added, you know, the expectations is that they would be part of the cabinet. But the president has had to, and the ANC negotiators has had to manage those expectations. So what we're likely to see is many of them accommodated in deputy president positions. Deputy minister positions, and not in the cabinet itself. But many of them will also be on the outside and perhaps accommodated in the legislature, in parliament.
Could you elaborate for me on why the DA believes it's so essential to have the power to select directors general and then review all tenders in the departments assigned to it? One senses, and you're obviously a lot closer to this than I am, that this has become something of a friction point between the ANC and the DA.
Absolutely, Jeremy. So the DA's perspective, which is understandable, is that they anticipate that there'll be backlash from loyal DGs to former ANC ministers. So this has happened in the past. I mean, it's happened in metros, in the city of Johannesburg, in the city of Ekurhuleni. It has happened. There is sort of experience that the DA's had with this in trying to run governments in the past. But on the other hand, you know, there's been a concerted effort to professionalize the public service and ensure that the DGs appointed to many departments are actually professional, and that they would work with any minister that comes in in after an election. And so that's the two perspectives. The DA's, you know, worried that it will be blocked at every turn to deliver and to prove that it can govern by the DGs that are not loyal to the party. And on the other hand, the ANC is concerned that allowing the DA to appoint or select DGs would allow them to sort of create a mini government, a mini DA government inside the broader GNU government. So There's concern on both sides, and valid concern on both sides of the argument.
Natasha, just explain to us as well the process of these talks. Is it happening at the Steenhuisen Ramaphosa level or the Fikile Mbalula Helen Ziller level? And how are those two platforms talking to or engaging with each other, if you follow what I'm trying to say?
Yes. So Jeremy, up to Sunday, the talks were at the Fikile Mbalula Helen Ziller level. There was a constant back and forth between negotiators, between party negotiators, and then the principals would meet John Steenhuisen and Cyril Ramaphosa every few days just to clarify where everyone was at and where things were at. But on Sunday, when the DA, when the ANC received the letter from the DA, where they made a considerable amount of demands, it then got escalated to the principals. The ANC then said, "Well, you know, this is above our pay grade." In essence, I'm not quoting them verbatim, but effectively they said this is above our pay grade. So it was escalated to John Steenhuisen and Cyril Ramaphosa, and that's where it's at, in my understanding, right now.
And Natasha, as a political journalist, are you satisfied with the information that is forthcoming from all parties? Because the sense I'm getting is that a lot of what we're hearing is from very strategically timed leaks.
Absolutely, Jeremy. That's the difficulty. You know, as political journalists, we're balancing what's in the public interest, but we're also very aware that there's very strategic leaks going on here. In fact, the whole furore around the letter started with the Sunday Times story over the leak around the deputy president position. So it's a difficult line to straddle for us as political journalists. But what could resolve that is if political principals take the nation into their confidence. It's a very important discussion that's going on. It's a very important negotiation. And frankly, I think the communication has been lacking. I think especially from the bigger parties, from the DA and from the ANC side. In a negotiation, you can't have report backs to the public at every stage, but at least every few days. I mean, it's been a week now since the president was inaugurated, and we've heard virtually nothing formally from the political principals, except President Ramaphosa's letter, which was in very vague terms on Monday, his presidential letter. So it has been quite difficult to get a real sense of what's going on because the communication hasn't been managed. I guess it is new terrain for all of us, especially at a national level, for political parties as well. But going forward, it is something that we should think about, you know, communicating better to take the nation into confidence around these crucial discussions.
You know, Natasha, I hope I don't see you on the course of next year's Comrades Marathon. That's all I can say, because it is getting exhausting. But what a pleasure talking to you, specialist political writer at News 24, one of the country's best political writers. Natasha Marion, I really do appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's wade into the weeds now. At some point, we are going to have a government of national unity, and attention is then going to turn to policy priority. And my next guest says that tackling economic exclusion has got to be number one as far as this new government is concerned when it comes to setting an agenda. And Thabiseng Moleko is a development economist at Stellenbosch University, and a very warm welcome to the program. So in your opinion, then, before we talk about policy, what are the most significant factors right now contributing to this economic exclusion that you talk about?
So I think the first indice that I'd use that talks to economic exclusion, we've got a labor market that has 7 out of the 9 provinces that statistics are going to be released today on unemployment, and it's not likely to be positive. So from the first quarter contraction, most economic sectors have actually not performed well. And the outcome of that you'll see is going to definitely not just only hinder the productivity, but also you're going to see it hitting very much on the households through unemployment. The first priority is that if you are sitting with more than 40% unemployment in 7 of your 9 provinces, and that is equivalent to 12 million unemployed South Africans that is in the labor market, you are sitting with a crisis of exclusion. Where this has impact is that the household consumption levels the household economic activity is really hit hard. And I think that if we understand the multiplier effect across economic sectors and the economic value chain, and the benefit of broadening participation of households at a household level, and particularly regionally where you don't see much economic activity. So the first point that you're asking about, where are we seeing this most? Labor markets. That's number one. The second aspect where we are seeing this most is in the economy, in terms of inclusion in the economic sectors. There is a lot of work that has been done looking at participation, but also looking at market dominance. Different entities have been looking at this. I know Competition Commission looks at concentration and market concentration. There's a different body that has now been looking at the participation of all the population in the economy. But if you look carefully at the SMME or the listed company transformation, there again, you see, when you look at the indices there, the participation, particularly of the historically disadvantaged, has not moved the needle sufficiently. And I don't want to go into the different economic sectors. We can look at whatever's of interest. But I think that if you look at ownership of those factors of production, the key indice there, Jeremy, is the capital allocation, market access. And so those two that hinder entry for new business entrants, market access and also capital allocation, those for me are the two conundrums that determine whether entrepreneurial opportunities are fully realized in different economic sectors. And so I think if we don't look carefully at how to deal with the labor market structural constraints, that's number one. We will sit with an economy that is not growing at the rate it needs to grow, but also an economy that is not growing with the participation, with an inclusive growth agenda that remains a conundrum in South Africa. Even if you had 5 to 6%, which is the highest we've had post-apartheid, at that point you sat with a 22% unemployment. So that is still a crisis. The second proponent is inclusivity in terms of business and enabling a business environment that has participation of new entrants, but also making sure that you have a large body in the market structure of market firms that can engage and participate, so that you don't have 3 to 4 firms taking 60 to 70% of the share of the market in that sector.
So given that you've got competing philosophies within a new government of national unity, how do you break any kind of deadlock, firstly, that is going to emerge from this? And second of all, how do you start setting key priorities to unlock some of the problems that you've outlined?
So the first thing is you have to agree on the program of action. A government has to have a priority. So if we all agree that South Africa's economic conundrum is a priority, the question then begins to be, what are the key principles that we need to put in place at a broad level and at a state level that require us to reach that target? So the first thing I would say is, irrespective of the political spectrum that we are coming from, if we can agree that unemployment is a crisis that needs to be responded to with urgency, right? I think that no one can disagree on that. Where the disagreement comes in is what instruments will take us there. But here is now, herein lies, I think, for me, the issue of where do we resolve the different ideological dispositions is what will get us there quicker. And I think that evidence-based planning is what will differentiate rhetoric and a narrative versus what will get us there. We have seen that market concentration, for an example, and dominance is not good for growth, is not good for new entrants. A lot of research has been done across the globe around this. Therefore, there are certain principles that we need to espouse to ensure that we broaden participation of new firms, right? This is on the sectoral level. If we look at unemployment and we look at the growth question, inequality has been proven to actually slow down growth. So the question is, inclusivity actually will increase the rate of growth. But the question is, what must be done to ensure that the labor market structural issues are broadened? And I think that that is now where the organization of the economic cluster, which I haven't seen, and I think we've had a discussion around these issues for quite some time now, where you organize your economic cluster, your agencies of the state in a fashion that ensures that from an evidence-based perspective, you see results and you actually see transformation and you actually see inclusivity, because the instruments that you need are not going to only come from the market. It actually is deliberate interventions that need to be put in place that will bring the transformation that is necessary. And I think that that is where the agreement has to come in. That is where the efficiencies have to come in. And that is where you're going to see a multiplier effect, even on the efficiencies of coordination among the state agencies. And I think working together and through collaboration, and I think parties have to look beyond now their own self-interest, but for the national good.
I'm going to leave it there and thank you so much indeed for that insight. Ntabi Seng Moleko, Development Economist at Stellenbosch University. Appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, let's move now from politics to defence. And Sandile Ndlovu, the Chief Executive Officer of the South African Aerospace, Maritime and Defence Industries Association, has issued a strong call to the newly appointed Minister of Defence and Military Veterans, when that appointment is made, obviously, for urgent and comprehensive investment in South Africa's national defence capabilities. He joins me on the programme now. And in terms, firstly, of equipment and investment, how would you describe the SANDF right now?
Well, Jeremy, it's terrible. The international norm on defense spending is around 2%. We are at 0.07%. So we do not even spend a percent of our GDP or on our defense and national securities. So that is on expenditure. As we speak now, the special defense account is sitting at zero. The special defense account is an account that the defense force uses to recapitalize its equipment. So they only have an operational budget now. They do not have any money to buy new equipment. And in as far as the equipment is concerned, Jeremy, you would like to know that in every second month, the presidential aircraft becomes unserviceable. So there is no aircraft in the Air Force that are fit and equipped to take the president. As a result, we end up resorting to charters. And of course, we pay quite a lot of money. We've got two missions in the DRC and Mozambique currently ongoing. We do not have the capability of sustaining those missions our own using Air Force aircraft. As a result, we have to charter very expensive aircraft. In the past 2 months, I think you would have heard stories and seen stories about Russian aircraft being used, or Russian-made aircraft, the Ulyanovs, being used to ferry equipment from South Africa to Mozambique and the DRC. The state of the Navy is no better, and the Army is even worse. So in as far as equipment is concerned, Jeremy, we are seriously, seriously behind the curve of replacing that equipment and maintaining it.
That's a very bleak picture that you paint for us. I'm assuming then that in terms of our real defense capability, we become more and more vulnerable all the time.
It is a fact. Every second day we hear stories of how our guys deployed in the DRC come under attack. We hear stories of how guys deployed in Mozambique come under attack. And the only reason that is happening at such a high frequency of late is because the rebels that we are up against have realized that we are not as strong as they thought we were, because they could see that we don't have the equipment to defend the troops that are in the mission areas. So we have become quite vulnerable. And the only saving grace for now is that some of the soldiers that we deploy are quite highly trained, so they can defend themselves somewhat. But training can only take you up to a point. You need proper equipment, serviceable equipment, in order to defend and protect yourself and your country fully.
Could you put a number on this problem? How much money do we need to fix things?
About 4 years ago, you'd recall that there was a defense review that was finalized and adopted by cabinet in 2015. When they did a sum of what was required to implement the defense review, they came to a number of about 50 to 75 billion rands. Of course, that was not going to be a once-off number. It was going to be an incremental or phased in approach. So if I were to give you an educated guess now, Jeremy, we need about 60 billion rands to put our defense force at least at a basic level of competency and capability in as far as the equipment is concerned. And that is why, and we understand that that money is just not there for the state to give. And that is why we are calling on the state to allow private funding to come and assist in resolving this problem.
How do you envisage then the proposed private funding model working in practice? So I'm assuming that there are benefits, there would be challenges, but there would also be a concern surely over confidentiality and security.
Yeah, well, I think the first point of departure on that, it would be to accept that the model that we are calling for calls for closer cooperation and partnership between the SANDF and private industry and, of course, the funders. Because without a close relationship and close cooperation, the model would fall flat in the case of a security project. And the reason it would require close cooperation is because generally the Defense Force would like to keep close to their chest information around operational readiness. Therefore, that information should not be made available to those that are only providing the funding and are not responsible for the service and the repair of the equipment or the replacement or even the manufacturing of the equipment itself. So we see a scenario where the South African defense industry and the South African Department of Defense enter into a close relationship that would allow the Department of Defense to communicate their requirements to our industry. And it then becomes our industry's responsibility to go and seek the funding without exposing the Defense Force to private funders. Once that is done, we then become responsible for manufacturing what is required or replacing it and then handing it over back to the Defense Force so that they can then do with it what they do best. But it also says, Jeremy, there has to be then a long-term relationship because the amounts that we are talking about are not the amounts that could be paid over a normal 3-year or 5-year period around which the contracts run currently. So it would call for a much longer relationship where we stay in for a long term to ensure that there is then that operational availability and serviceability of the equipment at all times.
Thank you very much indeed. Sandile Ndlovu, Chief Executive Officer of the South African Aerospace, Maritime and Defence Industries Association.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on the program, healthcare workers from the Prince Mashene Hospital in Umlazi in Durban are protesting over safety issues. So what is behind this and what impact on service delivery? The Healthcare Workers Union, the Public Servants Association of South Africa's Mlungisi Ndlovu joins us now. And first of all, what are the safety issues that you are referring to and how are they impacting on the staff's ability to provide proper service?
Firstly, on the 13th of June 2024, one of the staff member working clinic was hijacked and kidnapped. He was taken to the graveyard where criminal forced him to withdraw the amount of about 3,000. There have been some cases, in particular around Umlazi, when some of our members who are performing outreach program where they are being hijacked. As a PSA, we are very concerned about this escalating level of crime, and these criminals are very violent. They point out guns to our staff, and our members are very, very scared to visit this community. It is for this reason, as PSA, we have called upon the interventions of community leaders, the subs, and everyone that must come on board. By the way, it's not only Prince Mshini that is affected by this crime level. If you go to the part of northern part of KwaZulu-Natal, Mkanyagu, the King Tetwayo, Teleni Clinic, same things happened. Staff were hijacked when they were doing home visits. Some of the social workers experienced the same things. It is for this reason where we're saying to the Premier of KwaZulu-Natal, he need to produce a plan working with organized labor and all the stakeholders in terms of dealing with this high level of crime in our province.
How has the suspension then of the mobile clinic operations impacted on the communities that they serve?
It has impacted the community negatively. You'll recall that this mobile clinic that visit part of Umlazi, Folweni, and other areas of Imbumbulu, they visit different communities to provide medication and provide healthcare service. And some of these patients, they don't have, they're unemployed, they're unable to go to hospital, they're unable to go to certain clinics. It is for these reasons we are saying it has huge impact, because they've got all planned dates for the visits. You know, some of them, they were unable to collect their medication. So some of them are taking medication for TB and other chronic illness. So they will default. If they default, it end up creating more sickness. And some of them have opted to go to the hospital. Prince Imshiyane is known as overcrowding hospital, where there is challenge of infrastructure and other things. It is for these reasons we have written to the MEC and said we must be able to engage on this particular issue. So not only the mobile clinic, also ambulance are being affected, because criminals have targeted the state vehicle, and there is no plan from government and community to protect the public servants. So we are saying, as a PSA in the province of KwaZulu-Natal, if it's unsafe for our members, we appeal to them not to go there until the employer provide services and ensure that it is safe. If you look at Section 8 of the Occupational Health and Safety Act, it's very clear on the responsibility of the employer to attend to these matters.
What sort of response then have you had from the KwaZulu-Natal Department of Health?
Firstly, they have responded and suspended the mobile clinic, but it's a short-term solution. It has an impact, because our aim is not to prevent our members to service the communities. So they, we are still waiting for a response, because we need to have a comprehensive plan. I know the department will say, you know, there is high crime in KwaZulu-Natal, so there's nothing that you can do now. But we cannot normalize the situation where the criminals have taken over our life, because our members are losing a lot of stuff. Cell phone, some of them are losing their car keys. When it need to replace, it's come from their own pocket. So we're still yet waiting for the plan and also engagement, because we are saying we must engage. Because if they are not engaging, we're going to instruct our members not to go to places where they are unsafe. And we are saying to the department, they must come up with mitigation plans in terms of counseling, a proper counseling that need to be done, which should be short term and long term. Because I can tell you, some of our nurses, social workers are thinking of leaving some of these high hotspot areas like Umlazi, Kwamashwe, and other areas where they are being targeted by criminals.
It's an issue that goes beyond just criminality, though, from what I understand. You're also raising the issue of neglected infrastructure at the hospital. Again, what's the problem there, and what sort of response have you received to your complaints?
In actual fact, the questions that you have asked is very critical, because Prince Imshiyane is one of the few hospitals that still have asbestos. You know the impact of asbestos for community. It's even worse when it is in hospital. Prince Imshiyane has not been formed part of the bigger project. Even during COVID, when some of the hospital were renovated, it's at the bad state. That's why we challenge even the media house to visit that hospital. There are long queues, there's shortage of staff, there's not enough doctors, nurses, admin staff, cleaners. So it's in a crisis. So we're challenging both the MEC and the Premier of KwaZulu-Natal to prioritize it, because if you look at in Prince Imshiyane, it cater for the bigger communities. And Umlazi is one of the biggest township in the province and also in the country. So issues of infrastructure, it need to be attended to. Issues of shortage of staff, because at time, the citizen, when they wait in long queues, waiting to take medication and be attended, and there are not enough staff, you'll have a problem.
in the previous weeks, we have challenges, even of victimization of staff, where in ICU, staff were victimized by Metron, who did not want to engage with organized labor. As a result, they were traumatized. Some of them went off sick. Imagine 29 staff in the ICU that are being charged. Even when we want to engage with them, we are saying they should be focused in that hospital, because you need leaders with integrity. You need leaders that will care for community and care for the staff, because we also always encourage our members, when they service the public, they must service them with dignity. But if there's a shortage of staff, what do you do? Because we have seen the escalation of cases where nursing council are charging the nurses due to misconducts, you know, because they try to do their level best. There is less rest period and all other things. We are saying they should be focused with the NHI that has been signed by the president as a law, right? Now Prism Sheehan will not be ready in other hospitals. These are the fundamental issues that we're raising as a PSA, right, in the province. We are saying we are part of the stakeholders. They might see us not part of the political bigger picture, but we are non-political affiliated. We want these issues to be attended, and safety of the employee come first. We're ready to service the communities.
Right. But Longisi Ndlovu, I am going to cut across you there and leave it. I think we do get the picture. It is a very dire situation, and thank you for joining me on the program today. And before we leave you, our daily online poll: the Democratic Alliance's demand for 11 ministries in the GNU. Is it a fair demand? Is it outrageous, or simply a negotiating tool? If you have a view on that, I'd invite you to participate either on our X or LinkedIn pages, and I'll bring you the result of that poll tomorrow. That's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon and then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.